So one of my old bosses used to say, only move in baby steps. And I completely disregarded that advice.
This is Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, a podcast that explores why Montana leads the nation in entrepreneurship and business startups. I'm Arnie Sherman. While visiting Hawaii in 2009, Drake Dopke visualized creating a sushi restaurant in Big Fork, Montana, and conjured up the name Sakatumi. With no previous business ownership experience, Drake dove in headfirst and has successfully launched three distinctive Asian-themed restaurants in Montana over the past 9 years. Today on Can Do Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, Drake and I will talk about the trials by fire of starting a business from scratch and the alchemy of crafting a coherent customer experience of food, service, and ambiance that every restaurateur strives to achieve. Production support for this Can Do podcast comes from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. Welcome, Drake. So tell me about the genesis of Sakatumi and now Mishi Ramen.
Thanks for having me, Arnie. So the intro was correct. I lived in Kauai, and I was a beach bum looking to just surf wave, and that was pretty much my only life intention at that point. But I had traveled extensively throughout Asia by that point in my life, and my dad was a philosophy professor that used to teach in China and Nepal and Thailand, and so I spent a lot of my high school years in and out of Asia, and then I traveled through there solo for in and out of 6 years, probably. And then I was living in Hawaii. I was like, look, I used to live in Bozeman. I rolled sushi there at a place called Dave's. And I was like, I don't want to live where there isn't a beach. I mean, I might as well live where there's a beach. So moved to Hawaii. I had a holy van. It was called the holy van for a reason. I had to gorilla glue a tarp to the top of it. It was one of the old Vanagon vans, and we used to say the air conditioning was natural because there was a hole in the bottom left corner of the car. And it's tough living, but it's good if you like the waves. So
so you're a beach bum,
right,
in Hawaii,
right?
One night you come up with this idea of opening a sushi restaurant. You'd never run a business or owned a business before.
Correct.
And you ended up going to a seasonal small town.
Correct.
On a lake in Montana, which is a huge gamble because there's lots,
yes,
of restaurants that and businesses that come in and out of Big Fork, Montana. So how did you reach that conclusion to do that?
So I'd been doing this particular form of culinary art, sushi, for like 6 years. So I felt extremely comfortable making that food. And then it was that I was tired of driving and living in the holy van. So my folks live in Big Fork, Montana, and I had spent most of my post high school summers there. It's very beautiful. You know, it's got the pristine lake and mountains and all that. It's just idyllic during the summer. But like everyone who visits Big Fork, Montana in the summer, they're like, oh my God, this is Mecca. I've reached utopia, and this is where I'm going to reside. But the winters come, and it changes most people's minds. But we were able to make it stick. For the first couple of years, me and my girlfriend at the time, we would travel during the winters. So we would close it down, work the summers, travel to Asia during the winters, come back and do it all over again. And we did that for about 3 years. And I realized then it wasn't going to be sustainable in that format. You know, you got to find a new house and you got to find new employees. And it's just starting over every year from scratch. So I realized that that just had a ceiling to it that was pretty low. So 1 year, two of our employees were like, hey, like we'd love to keep it open and keep it running for the winter if you'd let us. And I said, sure, you know, give it a whirl. And they did. It wasn't wildly profitable or anything, but it sustained and it paid them and it kept the lights on and stuff like that. And then after that, it became apparent it had to be year round because there was enough people that lived there year round.
So you have the business in Big Fork. What led to the decision to come to Missoula and put an upscale, you know, two restaurant group, you know, on the main street of Missoula, Montana?
So one of my old bosses used to say, only move in baby steps. And I completely disregarded that advice. So we're still in the experimental part of that venture, but it used to frustrate me. The seasonality, the feast and famine, it was like, you know we have a good product. People love our food. You know, we have good relationships with our clientele. Like, but then, you know, the winter comes and all of a sudden there's no one there. It was frustrating. It was like, if we just had a spot that was less seasonal, then, you know, we would just be busier all the time. And it'd be easier in a lot of ways because you could hire and you could staff it and you could, you know, have managers and run it, you know, like a true business. So Missoula, Montana was an obvious decision for me personally because I love it. You know, I used to go to school in Bozeman, but I always had an affinity for Missoula, and it's kind of the closest bigger town.
You do something in the Missoula operation that's a little bit unusual. You have one building with two separate distinct restaurants. The main floor is Sakatumi, and the lower level is Mishi Ramen. What was the thought process behind doing it that way?
Sushi is a fickle, fickle beast. You can only go so large without hitting on a quality loss, in my opinion. And I had always wanted to own a ramen restaurant. I have a massive affinity for ramen. When I go to Japan, I search out as many ramen joints as I can, as much as sushi. I mean, they are equal in my affinity.
So let's get to the crux of an issue that resonates, I think, with me that I want to get an answer to. You have two sushi restaurants and one ramen restaurant, and usually you find Asian lineage in Asian-themed restaurant. So you're not Asian.
That's right.
How do you strive to make the experience as authentic as possible?
You know, I think it's tough. I've never claimed to be authentic. That's never been what I would say. But I've spent some time in Tokyo now. And what I've realized about the Japanese specifically, kind of even more so than any of the other cultures, is they're highly experimental. You know, there's more French Michelin restaurants in Japan than there are in France. In fact, it's kind of funny because the Western style of sushi, which is this, it's all the stuff on top, it's the rolls, it's the different ingredients, it's you know, it's the more kind of playfulness that you wouldn't see in like a traditional omakase based sushi restaurant, has actually been embraced now in Japan. It's kind of gone backwards, and they're starting to do these fusion style sushi restaurants as well. So I think just in my own heart, I want to make interesting food. So for me, I have such an affinity for Asia that it's just where I'm connected to. It's where my kind of heart resonates to. So I do like to maintain the backbone of like, okay, look, we have to get the highest quality product. We have to like make the rice the right way. We got to season the rice the right way. We got it like, you know, and so if you want to have a sashimi, it's like the right sashimi. If you want to have nigiri, it's the right nigiri. And then if you want to have rolls, then rolls are just kind of as crazy as you can possibly get. So
2009, you're living in the Holy Van, rolling sushi, living a different kind of beach bum kind of life. Fast forward to now, you're the chef, you designed the concept, you have a multi-location business, you're responsible for the finances of all this, the employees, the hiring, all the things that go into running a business. What did you have to learn first to launch this thing?
The original?
Yeah.
When I first looked at businesses, I looked at them like, I don't even know how people start them. I mean, how do you even do it? And that's the way I was. I looked at it being like, I want to own a sushi bar. How do you do that? So, I mean, literally I got on Google and I was like, how do you do it? And, you know, it was, okay, first I got to start the entity, right?
It's surprising how many of my guests in the series have told me that they've learned how their craft from Googling it.
You just, unless somebody taught you, unless your dad was a business owner, and mine wasn't, he was a philosophy professor, and unless you had somebody who was like, hey, this is how you start a business, it's not obvious, I think, when you're, especially when you're younger, it's not obvious. So, you know, you got to start an entity, and, you know, you have to register it with the IRS, and you got to register it with the state, and there's, but really, it's not complicated. It's really not complicated to create an entity. So that was something that really opened my eyes. I was like, look, okay, these are things that you can do. This is things that you can start. But then there's drumming up capital. There's, you know, demographic analysis. But none of that went into the origination of Sakatumi. It was, I've got $10,000, which is nothing. I'm going to buy a bunch of used equipment off of eBay and restaurants that have gone under in the local area. I'm going to make all the art inside the restaurant myself. I got 10,000 bucks. That's all I got. I'm going to work it, and I'm going to have one other person work it with me.
So how many employees do you have now?
I think it's 60.
So you've grown the business to 60 employees, and you were responsible for this total experience concept of food service ambiance. How did that all come about?
So when I used to travel, when I was younger, it really was kind of that light bulb thing where you would go into a space that somebody had really thought about. I can even tell you where I first really experienced it. It was in this bar restaurant in Kathmandu called Rum Doodle. And it's in Temel, which is kind of like the expat part of Kathmandu. The ambiance, the food, just the feeling of the place. It was that there was a light bulb moment. I'm not saying that lightning needs to strike for people to know what they need to do, but it didn't really resonate for me until later on in my life that was something that I just really appreciated. But I felt it. You could feel it in your bones. You could see it. There was this genius behind the idea of creating this dining experience. And they don't have to be Michelin. I've had dining experiences on the streets of Vietnam in a plastic chair with a guy cooking out of a clay pot that's in my top five dining experiences of all time. So they're all different. They're unique. And so, yeah, so it's just been something that I've started to kind of pay attention to.
What do you find most enjoyable about this restaurateur experience, and what do you find the most challenging?
The enjoyable aspect is the people, right? I mean, so that's, I think, honestly, when you boil everything down, that's ultimately what it comes down to. It's the employees that you work with. It's the guests. It's the community. That's why you do it, right? Because, I mean, otherwise, why are you doing it? So that's great. So you build those relationships. You make those contacts. And from a restaurant perspective, for me, I just saw it as being one of the easiest ways to come in contact with people. I've met so many people through the restaurant business because people go out to eat. You're not going to do that if you go to the movies. You're not interacting with people that much. So for me, it's about building personal relationships. What's the hardest thing about restaurants? People. So it's the double-edged sword. You're managing people's lives, right? So you have, everyone's got their thing. They've got their idiosyncrasies. They've got their hangups. They've got their sensitivities. And all that has to be navigated. So, yeah, I think it's really more about just interpersonal relationships than anything.
Plus, you have the challenge that in Missoula, the unemployment rate is 2.3%. How do you find good employees?
I think it's based on what you hit on, that dining experience thing. I mean, we did try to create a building that was unique and beautiful and stuff like that. So being a cook myself, it resonates with other cooks. If we can talk shop, a little bit. So I've noticed that has helped with recruiting cooks and just having an enthusiasm for cooking, and it turns people on, and I think it makes it more than just a job. Service staff is harder in a way, because what you're hiring is college students, and they're not. It's not that they don't care or they're not, it's just not their vocation. It's not, they can be very nice people. They can be very accommodating people. They can be hardworking people.
But they're going to do something else later on in life.
This isn't their, this isn't their occupation. This isn't, and so it's hard to get those people to understand the value of it beyond just a paycheck, right? But I try to encourage them to see the value in it. Because even if, let's say you work this job for 4 years, well, that's a pretty big chunk of your life. And what if you developed wine knowledge and food knowledge and, you know, a better way of interpersonal relating with people? And I mean, a lot of my friends that have worked for me in the past or worked with me in the past have made amazing connections that have furthered their lives in ways that they never would have. What that door hadn't opened yet. And the same is true for me, just relating with the guests. So it goes into, for me, like a deeper idea, which is just whatever you're doing, just do it as well as you can possibly do it. Why not learn about the wine? Why not learn about the food? I guarantee you're probably going to want to travel someday, and that's going to make your life so much more interesting that you actually know the difference between what's good and what's not. And so I can't stress it enough. I think just focus on the how, not so much the what.
Like many people in Missoula, I get a lot of visitors. I say, let's go out to dinner. Let's get sushi. They look at me like I'm crazy. They say, we're hundreds of miles from the ocean. So how do you ensure a fresh supply of fish here?
What used to be a problem even 10 years ago, even 20 years, I mean, obviously 20 years ago, you had to be coastal for a good sushi restaurant to exist. And that's just not true now. I mean, distribution has become ridiculous. I mean, with the advent of things like Amazon and UPS and Facebook and all that, trying to keep up with the demands of people all over the nation, the idea of concentrated cosmopolitan areas and coastal regionality is just not as important as it used to be, because distribution has gotten so good and travel has gotten so good. So, yeah, I mean, we go to the airport. I mean, you got to go to the airport because you got to get it flown in, right? So from a seafood perspective, you still got to expedite the process. You still have to get it quickly. But I always inform my customers that it's really more about the way the fish is treated from water to however it's going to be stored. I mean, I used to, you know, in Hawaii, these fishermen would go out in their little dinghies and they'd go catch Ono and get drunk and, you know, hang out on the sun. And then they'd come in with these, you know, fresh Ono. You know, they'd only been caught like 2 hours before, but they'd been sitting on the warm deck. And I was like, I'm not buying that from you. Like, because that was more, granted, they had just caught it, you know, so it wasn't necessarily the time. It was, you know, time from out of water into ice and treating it correctly and all that. So, you know, gutting it and all that. So I don't think that's so as important as it used to be.
So from a beach bum with 10 grand in your hand,
right,
and starting in Big Fork, how did you finance the rest of the operation?
I mean, that was it.
So you've never taken an outside financing?
For the Missoula one, I had to take out a loan for like equipment. So when we expanded the one in Big Fork, and I made a mistake, which was, you know, I had saved money over 6 years of running that business, and I had a little bit of a cash storage, and I was like, okay, I'll expand. Makes sense, capitalize on more of a market, and it did make sense, but I burned pretty much all of my own savings to do it. It would have made more sense to finance in that case. But I have had support along the way. I mean, I've had people reach out to me. There was a time when I needed to buy the building in Big Fork because the price had kind of dropped below a point, and all of a sudden there were investors in the water and they wanted to buy the building, right, and have me as a tenant. They saw it as a viable thing. And fortunately, my mom, who's a real estate agent up there, knew a lot of people. She kind of reached out to a couple of people and said, hey, let's buy the building. Let's, you know, let's let Drake buy the building and we'll have him pay you back. So basically they acted as the bank to buy the building. And now I'm making mortgage payments essentially, but to private investors. And the same is true for Missoula. So once I did the expansion up there, people saw that it was like, okay, this is like starting to become more than just, you know, Drake and Fish and, you know, a couple of servers. You know, people started noticing and they started reaching out and being like, hey, like.
So it's friends and family money.
Yeah, I mean, so it kind of comes around, you know, once it gets to a certain point. I mean, I didn't go to like VC capital firms and say, hey, I need X and this is my business model or something like that. I just operated my business and people started kind of showing up.
Besides the mistake you already alluded to of investing your own money in Big Fork, as you look back, you know, knowing what you know now, what, if anything, would you have done differently?
So the Big Fork thing was, you know, in a lot of people's minds, like, why would you do it? I mean, I've been asked thousands of times over all the years of why would you open a restaurant in Big Fork, Montana? I mean, it's like you get 3 months. I mean, why? But for me, it was great because it was a training ground. It let me grow as a business person. I was 25 years old. I literally had no business experience whatsoever. So, and Big Fork is a great community. They're an understanding community. They're a tight-knit community. They also have a lot of snowbirds. So they have people coming in from Arizona and Florida and all that. So there was some money there as well. So looking back on it now, you could say, well, yeah, just open a place in a larger town with a bigger demographic. But there's no way we could have done the Missoula project without doing Big Fork. Big Fork was like a training ground. I mean, I learned how to use QuickBooks. I learned how to balance a bank account. I learned how to get the fish on the right schedule. I just learned everything about what it took to run this business. So I don't regret that decision at all. The Missoula project, like I said, one of my old bosses said, you know, baby steps, always baby steps. And it wasn't a baby step, but I don't regret it either. Maybe I will. I don't know. It's still early on. But it's a completely different monster. I mean, there's a stretch. It'll rack you. It'll beat your nerves up.
I had a friend who had a restaurant in Hamilton, Montana, Italian restaurant. And it would drive him crazy because guests would order pasta and then ask for ketchup. Are our customers in Missoula familiar with sushi and ramen, or do you have to go through an education process with them?
Missoula's funny. They are so discerning in a way. So no, they get it. They know it. They've probably been other places. You know, they may have moved from other places. What I'm seeing is that most of them know kind of a base, at least a base. So there's not a huge education there. There was in Big Fork, massive.
So what's the future look like? What are the next stages for you? The baby steps. What are the next baby steps for you?
Apparently, I don't move in baby steps anymore. So, yeah, there's a couple of new projects already coming down the pike. I don't want to move too fast because I want to make sure that Sakatumi and Michi is going to be an establishment, not just a flash in the pan. So I want to focus on that. I want to make sure that is correct and accurate and being done correctly and all that, and you know, and being involved in that. But yeah, no, it's kind of weird because I find myself in this position now where it's, are you a cook or are you a restaurateur? And I think it's moving more in the direction of being a restaurateur. So it's more on the development side of things now. So yeah, no, there's a couple of new projects and I'm sure we'll talk about them again soon, but I'll keep them under wraps for now.
Drake, it's been a pleasure talking with you. It's made me hungry.
Yes.
I look forward to visiting your restaurant.
Perfect.
And hearing about the future.
Awesome, Arnie.
Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Tonight.
I appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs. Produced by Autumn Barnes and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guest contact information and content from all our shows. Listen next time to Can Do, and our guest will be Robin Bacay of Bacay's Caramels, discussing the dramatic growth of her Bozeman, Montana-based confectionery enterprise. I'm Arnie Sherman, wishing you peace and prosperity. Production support for this Can Do podcast comes from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com.